Britain 1971, a country with its back turned to the world and governed by an isolationist coalition that's dismantled the special relationship with America and is preparing to go to war with a united Europe. A country that has fixed its deep economic depression by selling off the Greenbelt to property developers. One of the few verdant spaces left in this alternative England is London Zoo. And the zoo is a microcosm of the country, a place of faction fighting, bullying, monstrosity, a place headed for catastrophe and the brutalities of what comes after catastrophe. This is the world of Angus Wilson's The Old Men at the Zoo. Written in 1961 and set in the following decade, it's one of the great comic novels of the last century, the signature work of a remarkable writer born 100 years ago, but who, even in his centenary year, is unjustly neglected. This edition of Night Waves is one of those devoted to a single work. Landmarks, we call them. But The Old Men at the Zoo is a landmark that has lost its place on the cultural map, and undeservedly so. The prickly hero of the novel, Simon Carter, is a former BBC producer who takes an administrative job at Regent's Park during a political crisis. He oversees the migration of the animals to a new national park in Wales, but brings them back again as Europe totters towards war. Miraculously, the zoo survives the attack, but in the post-apocalyptic world, it changes its role and becomes a place where political prisoners are executed. So I went to ZSL London Zoo, and by the penguin pool I met two people who know the novel well, the writer Ian Sinclair and the novelist Margaret Drabble, Angus Wilson's friend and also his biographer. Maybe we should begin by trying to make a case for this novel, because it's somewhat neglected, and as a work of fiction it's very hard to categorise, isn't it, Margaret?
It is, and maybe that's one of the reasons why it is neglected. It's a satirical portrait, it's a plea for wildlife, it's ecologically quite advanced and aware, it's full of premonitions about how things are going to get worse. In his little foreword, he says that he hopes that Britain will not be as bad as this, but fears it may be worse. So he was full of foreboding in the 1960s. And of course, we were all very afraid of the Cold War, the atom bomb, and this sinister feeling lies behind the plot. And of course, history's moved on. It's quite hard to recapture our fear of the atom bomb, as we used to call it. But the novel, to me, is a wonderfully told story of intricately connected personalities and battles about the future of democracy, really.
How would you characterise the book, Ian?
Well, it's a great cultural cross-section, because Wilson's using his own knowledge of the workings of bureaucracy and the establishment in Britain from his period in the Bletchley Park with the secret state, and then working at the British Library. So he puts all that, which is the nature of Britain as a kind of dying imperialist power, and puts it all into this zoo space, which works beautifully as the metaphor for everything that happens in culture, because zoos adjust and reinvent themselves all the time, from the point where they're just exotic beasts kept by the royal family to a point where they're having to deal with issues and health and safety and entertainment and Disneyland, finance, the political class already absurd and corrupt. Europe is a sort of dangerous entity that threatens us. So all kinds of fears and paranoias of the time are brought into play with beautiful social detail. And I think the other quality that's there right at the opening of the book is a sense of poetry and genuine love of the creatures of the zoo. And obviously you wouldn't associate him with it, but I think he had a very good eye for animal behaviour. And there's a sort of eros that's running below it all, that's cooking away and keeps the thing boiling in the sense of the great Victorian novels.
The novel kicks off in the giraffe house, doesn't it, Margaret? Almost literally.
Literally, yes. It opens with a scene of unexpected death in the giraffe house, and the whole political plot within the zoo spills out from there. An unfortunate young keeper who hasn't been trained for long enough is kicked by a giraffe that should have been put down because of a tumour, and all the plot begins to unravel from the confrontations that ensue there. And it's a very surprising, violent opening, because as we know, and as Angus Wilson reminds us, giraffes are very peaceable creatures normally. Things are going to go wrong. Chaos is on its way.
the other aspect of it is that Angus points out is that giraffes have no vocal cords. So this is a huge, silent, elegant beast, and the keeper screams. There's a terrible noise that cuts through this opening because, as is made clear, the giraffe has stamped on his testicles, which, again, in a Wilsonian way, has to be told and without shocking the women who are present in the office. So there's a whole sort of social comedy around this terrible incident, and that acoustic thing cuts through the poetry of the opening, where he beautifully describes flamingos and colours and smells in a way that's just like J.G. Ballard, and then brings in the sound of a jet aeroplane coming across it, which again is like Ballard, and which signals up the fact that we're going to be invaded by war.
Suddenly the screaming began. I knew they were human cries, yet the noise was further from what's usually meant by a human scream than many animal or bird calls. As the first deep groans, there must have been 8 or 9 of them, rose each in turn to a high sound somewhere between a monkey's shriek and a sudden release of air from vast balloons, Patty Henderson's diagram of a seal's bowels swam on the paper in front of me, and my own bowels heaved within in fright and horror. I rushed to the door. By the time I'd left my room, the noise was drowned in the panic orchestra of roaring lions and baying sea lions, of hyenas' idiot schoolgirl giggles, of wolves, of bears, of howling gibbons and chattering monkeys, of trumpeting stags and the crowing, lunatic shrieks of the peacocks near the window. It sounded as though every creature was rushing, as I had done, to leave its cage.
What should we make of the political world of the novel, Margaret? Could you sort of sketch out the landscape for us?
The landscape consists of a European force uniting against a coalition Britain. There's an extraordinary portrait of Lord Godmanchester, who's a sort of cross between Beaverbrook and Lord Goodman, a kind of both good bad character. He's the governor of the zoo, and he owns most of the press, and he is manipulating public opinion entirely to suit himself and his own career. Lord Goodmanchester is hoping to be recalled to office because of the threat of war. He's hoping that he can manipulate the zoo in order to, and it, his newspapers, in order to get back into power on the outbreak of war. And it is just an extraordinarily perceptive portrait of somebody with many good qualities, but who is dangerous on the loose. That there's a threat of war, a sort of tension of war behind the whole unravelling of the plot.
And how does that reflect Britain at the beginning of the 1960s?
Pretty well, I think. And the other aspect of this book is the superpowers, Russia and America, have kind of withdrawn and are letting Europe get on with this terrible mess. And I think the Britain coming into the 60s, you know, people talk about the 60s, but I think the 60s we imagine didn't really start till about 1965. So this is saturated in the sense of having survived the war, rationing book Britain, petrol is short. He's going back, you know, in a sort of Orwellian way, in one way, to describe a particular situation by analysing very accurately what had been happening in the past. And that makes a new present, which we don't know how it's going to go. And Angus Wilson was interested in that as well, because he started to write books that reflected the modes of the 60s.
There are quite a few echoes of 1984, in fact. We haven't reached the developed stage of 1984, but as you said, there are kind of signs that there is the writing on the wall. And Simon Carter's career as narrator does slightly follow the downfall of Winston Smith, in that you end up far, far worse than you thought you were going to. It's as though Angus Wilson was showing us, before it gets too extreme, this is where we are. It's like a warning book, I think. It's a warning. These things will happen if we don't watch out.
The dystopian aspect that 1984, this novel sits very squarely in an English tradition that would have taken on books like The State of Denmark, which was written by Robin Cook, who also wrote as Derek Raymond, in the 60s, just after this, picturing England as being this sort of Orwellian state with surveillance and all of that, and going right through to Alan Moore's graphic novel V for Vendetta. So people keep coming back to these state of the nation things, and this one is great because it's done in the sort of Dickensian spirit with multiple characters and a great spans of time and history.
There is a sense, though, isn't there, of Wilson speculating from the starting point of his own moment, in that we get a mention of the MacLeod government of the late 60s, which I take to be a reference to Ian MacLeod, who was Secretary of State for the Colonies at the time that Wilson was writing.
Yes, he's playing around with characters who were still alive and who would have been recognisable as portraits to people of our generation, and speculating about what would have happened to them had history gone slightly differently, what would have happened if MacLeod hadn't died, John Smith hadn't died. We all go in for these speculations. I think Angus keeps going back to his own experiences before the outbreak of World War II and his involvement with the Peace Pledge Union and the gradual realisation that neutrality is not enough, appeasement is not enough, it's not going to work. And then the kind of sense of sickening foreboding when you realise that war is going to come anyway. And in the novel, the tension is kept up so well because you're never sure whether war is going to come. The reality of the tension between the husband and wife and the dissolution of their marriage is set against this backdrop, and it must have happened so many times over.
I think he's really good in the central character, who's very unlikable. He's really a creepy operator.
This is Simon Carter.
Simon Carter, the young man who's come in, you know, because he's got administrative skills, and he's put up against these old men at the zoo who represent various periods. They love the Decimus Burton architecture, they might love the modernist, you know, there are different people with different interests, but this character is prophetic. He's kind of Blairite, way ahead of time. He's very smooth, he's very slick, he's very good on TV. So he anticipates what have now become the political crisis. And people didn't like him, and I think that was one of the difficulties with the book, is that he was so unlovable.
He's an unlovable narrator, and he enjoys manipulating people, as Angus Wilson himself did, though he did it with much more charm. But it's very interesting to watch Angus Wilson, who was a manipulator of people, envisaging this character who is not at all likeable, but who is actually quite efficient. Angus Wilson always spoke up for the conscientious civil servant, doing his job properly without fear of the money interests or the newspaper interest or sensationalism. I don't think he had foreseen, though you can read into it, the health and safety excesses that we now sometimes worry about. But it's on the verge there, wouldn't you say, on the verge of him being aware that we may go too far with bureaucracy in controlling the wild. I'm not quite sure that I agree with Ian that he's going to be a Tony Blair figure, because he's got some principle about the wild that he clings to, and about the zoo not being an environment where animals are at a disadvantage. But of course the storyline goes against him in a very savage way.
And geographically it's very interesting in this part of London, because he and his wife live in that sort of wealthy zone, Primrose Hill. Primrose Hill was where Blake thought he saw the spiritual sun. When I was here in 1967 with the American beat poet Allen Ginsberg, we're on Primrose Hill, and he wants to see Blake's tigers in the zoo. So we're walking through the zoo, and he's staring at these creatures. And that's something that's almost unimaginable stage beyond what Angus Wilson was describing. But it shows that the zoo was exactly the pertinent thing to do. The way that Regent Street, James Burton's architecture, leads into this park, then the enclosure, is very, very crucial to the sort of spiritual well-being of a city. How the zoo operates, how we live with it.
And the human habitations round here are one of Britain's earliest gated communities, aren't they? So we're in a zoo within a zoo.
We're in a zone of a real, real sense of privilege, and one of the spots, if you go to the top of Primrose Hill, where you can actually see the spread of the whole city, what the city means, and the first thing you're looking at is the zoo and Snowden's aviary, and Post Office Tower, and the new electronic world, all of that. This is the site where William Blake wanted to put his Jerusalem. I mean, you know, here we are, the pillars of it. And the zoo would be a crucial element in all that. And I think it was very smart of Angus Wilson to pick this as his zone of London.
Well, Angus Wilson, as we know, lived in his London home in Regent's Park Terrace with an excellent view of the zoo and excellent kind of sounds all night from the zoo. So I think it haunted his imagination simply by the proximity of living in the area that you've so well described as being visionary.
Let's talk a bit more about the apocalyptic nature of this book and that moment when war comes, Ian. How can we characterise that?
It's shocking. I mean, within this world that we've established, the terrible thing that has been floating in the background and was in all of our lives, you know, if we'd grown up in that period, the image of the atom bomb being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was haunting everything, but it wasn't actually going to happen. Maybe it's there. And now in this book, it does happen. And the concentration camp in England is out in Enfield, which is on the edge of Epping Forest, which, you know, all a very peculiar place to be. And I think this moment when you're dropped into a totally different kind of book gives you a real shock, a physical shock, that the characters are walking through this landscape, which is the landscape of the sort of suburbia of London petering out into something that's extremely nasty. And you do begin to feel that he's imaginatively made a leap into something that he couldn't know about, but is anticipating another kind of writing altogether. That's the great sense of the span that he does, from understanding the kind of way the Victorian novel works and its horrors, to exactly what's coming up in the J.G. Ballard world, where you have flamingos and jets passing across the London landscape.
But there are memories of World War II and refugees. In Europe, we didn't have the same streams of refugees leaving the cities here as happened in France. But these images would have haunted him as a young man, and they surface very strongly. And the idea of people starving, dying in the street, it is very shocking, because you've come from a world which seems almost normal. I mean, it was 1971, it wasn't sort of 1984 from his point of view. It was very near, and all the more shocking for that.
I think the other pertinent thing that comes just before that is this idea of all of the political classes and the media all agree they're going to have this grand event. There's a notion, a big national grand event,
like British Day,
anticipating
it's called, isn't it?
The opening of the Olympics perfectly. And this is the grand smokescreen. This is how we do it. And it is a complete and absolute shambles. For all of the people who wished not so well on that moment and didn't get it, this is, they can read this and enjoy it, because that is the other side of it. It happens in the zoo, and it's a complete catastrophe.
And it's like the opening of, what was that thing called, the Dome O2?
It even has zones.
And it's as though he'd foreseen the whole thing, and he'd foreseen it going wrong and people getting stuck in the turnstiles and worse. And he really relished that. He does enjoy it. He did love a Saturnalian scene. He loved a scene of real disaster. And Hemlock and After ends with one. I mean, and he loved Dostoevsky's scenes when everything goes totally wrong and ends in mayhem. And so I think to do it with the zoo, with the animal aspect as well as the human aspect, was really inspired.
We're on the brink of a war, man. This time, Strawson really did smile. We may be on the brink of eternity, Mr. Carter, but no siren has sounded yet. Meanwhile, a little colour. The rest of his words were lost in music swelling out from the amplifiers in every part of the gardens. At the same moment, floodlights were played on all the houses, tableau and pools. Woken by the unnatural day, lions and tigers began to roar, birds to scream, sea lions and monkeys to howl. The fountains sent up their coloured showers, and now, suddenly, to crown it all with a hissing and a crackling, the great fireworks set pieces began to give out their showers of coloured lights. God save our gracious Queen! The British lion and the Indian elephant came alive in glorious sulphurous blue, and demon red and palest amber white. And through it all, the music sounded. Mid pleasures and palaces, though we may roam, be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. I saw Bobby Falcon mounting the high platform erected in front of the Lion House. "Ladies and gentlemen," he cried into the microphone, and his voice echoed far away across the park, "we are not as many as I could have wished. We are only a few, but we're the lucky buggers. They'll all go out in their grey dreariness. We'll go out as a high old, rare old, bloody beautiful joke." Immediately his words were drowned in the belly-churning wails of 100 sirens. Then there was an absolute silence, followed by cries of panic and some shouts of anger. One or two of the staff began to run towards the tunnel as to the nearest shelter. Others picked up stones and threw them at Bobby. And then came the crackling, whistling, thudding sound of an explosion that filled the universe. Whatever had fallen must have been far off, yet blast had wrecked and twisted zoo buildings. The old zoo was in flames, and from it came the agonizing screams and roars of hippos, rhinos, zebras, apes, and trumpeting elephants.
That moment of war seems to bring out the natural surrealism of the zoo. I mean, you have kind of burning animals running through this space we're in now. It made me think of eyewitness accounts of the bombing of Belgrade during the war, where you get accounts of like burning antelopes running through the street. Or that during the siege of Paris, César Ritz produced this handmade recipe book telling you how to make blood pudding from elephants, this kind of thing.
It's quite interesting and pertinent how war focuses the mind on the zoo. Suddenly people start thinking about the zoo. And I believe that the actual snakes and venomous reptiles were killed within the zoo just in case they should get out into the city. Really a strange idea, as if the first threatening thing, suddenly the wild within us is something we need to look at. And the moment of war will release it. So the animals would be there in the streets with us, burning, flaming, savaging, devouring us. What are we going to do? We have to protect ourselves from the thing within.
Let's get some sense of the author of the Old Men at the Zoo. What kind of man was Angus Wilson? What was his background?
He was the youngest of a...
Attention, please. This is a staff announcement. We will shortly be testing the animal escape alarm. Ooh. Please note that this is only a test and not to be acted upon. Thank you.
I feel we had a Wilsonian moment there.
Oh, no.
It makes me think of the opening, not only the opening of the book, where the ambulance is coming through the zoo to rescue poor Filson, who's just been kicked in the balls by a giraffe, but also when, you know, the sirens go off when the bomb hits the institution.
Yes, and here we are in the centre of London with these sinister sounds around us.
Is that the all clear, do you think? And the gibbon is replying. Let's start talking about Wilson again, shall we? What kind of man was Angus Wilson? What was his background?
He was born into a sort of upper middle class decayed family, not much money, living in South Kensington. Elderly parents, went to Westminster, to Oxford, didn't know what to do with himself, was gay, but it was hard times to be gay in. Got a job at the British Library. The war came. He then worked at Bletchley Park, which was a very unhappy period for him, as it was probably for most people there. Though being gay, as we know from Turing's life, was not then an issue. It became an issue later. But he was very unhappy, had a nervous breakdown of a sort, went to see an analyst in Oxford and began writing, because the analyst said, why don't you write some short stories? And he became a writer and had quite an early success with his short stories and became a professional writer thereafter.
So how well established was he by the time he wrote The Old Men at the Zoo?
He was very well established. He was one of the most important writers of our language. He was widely admired, on the whole well reviewed. I think The Old Men at the Zoo had slightly problematic reviews because it is a very strange novel. But he was considered absolutely mainstream. His publishers thought he was going to win the Nobel Prize. I remember waiting for his novels with such anticipation and excitement and would go and buy them as soon as they came on the market. He was the favourite writer of many people.
And what impression did you form of him, Ian?
My sense of him was of somebody who was incredibly generous and wide-reaching in his sympathies and was also a very substantial writer. I mean, he wasn't a personal favourite of mine, and I started to read him more closely later when I probably got more of a sense of respect for the craftsmanship, just the way these books were put together.
So what was your attitude to him earlier then?
Well, earlier I felt he was probably too established for me to deal with at that point. I mean, he was head of this, chairman of that, he was dining all the time. I mean, that was a very superficial take on it on my point of view. I quite enjoyed reading people like Iris Murdoch and Angus Wilson for for the way they dealt with these worlds that I had no knowledge of or intimacy with, the collegiate worlds, the bureaucracies, the manipulations. I read it as something hugely remote. And now I read Old Men at the Zoo as very much a London novel in a tradition that I know better and I'm very sympathetic with.
How did you come to encounter him, Margaret?
As a person? I think I met him possibly through the Arts Council. I mean, he was very involved with the Arts Council. Again, there are lots of echoes of Arts Council bureaucracy in the Old Men at the Zoo. And he looked out for younger writers, he encouraged people, and I just came to admire his good humour, his generosity, his sweetness of nature. I mean, to see him pacifying Christopher Logue when Christopher Logue was in a bad temper was a wonderful thing to see. He had a great social range, Angus Wilson. He could get on with anybody, and I admired that enormously.
He must also have been one of the first openly gay figures in British public life as well.
He certainly was, yes. He had a long-term partner, very steady partnership for many decades with Tony Garrett. Indeed, they were filmed on Angus's 70th birthday here in this very zoo.
Oh, I want to talk about that.
Wonderful shots of them together. So he never concealed his relationship. He supported the campaign for homosexual equality. He was outspoken, but not, I would say, provocative. He was always a bit of a diplomat, but also a bit of a bohemian. He was a very interesting mix as a person.
We're going to take a bit of a detour now. In 1983, The Old Men at the Zoo was adapted for the nuclear age. It was adapted for television by Troy Kennedy Martin, the screenwriter of The Italian Job and Edge of Darkness. The BBC Two drama was filmed here in the zoo, and it took Wilson's story to a much more explicitly bleak conclusion. A post-war fascist government takes power. Carter and other former employees are reduced to the status of zoo animals. Their faces are bandaged. They're given cute pet names and sent to concentration camps, zoos for political dissidents.
We reopen as part of a greater purpose. As part of One Europe's plan to re-educate the nation to face the future. And that means coming to terms with our own violence. It is no accident that we, who live close to the animal kingdom, should present the scientific principles which form the basis of the One Europe movement.
Marius Goring as Dr. Englander addressing the nation in the TV adaptation of The Old Men at the Zoo. Well, I've now left the zoo and am high up above it on Primrose Hill, but from here we can still see the craggy shape of the Mappin Terrace and the swoop of the Snowdon Aviary. And I'm here with two alumni of Troy Kennedy Martin's adaptation of Old Men at the Zoo, its production manager, Margot Hayhoe, and its producer, Jonathan Powell, who's now Professor Jonathan Powell of Royal Holloway, University of London. Jonathan, why did you make this at this time in the early 80s?
There were kind of a lot of different reasons for wanting to do it, really. I mean, that time I was sort of loosely in charge of doing classic serials for BBC Two. And we'd tried to alternate between doing the great classics like The Barchester Chronicles and Crime and Punishment and so on and so forth, things we did, to having a look at slightly more contemporary pieces. And I was looking for our next project that was going to be in that vein, something which was kind of first-rate British novel, but which was not seen as a classic, and brought a sort of contemporaneity to the whole output. And I stumbled across The Old Men at the Zoo, and I read The Flyjacket. I thought, God, this sounds absolutely fantastic. And I started reading it, and it was so completely unlike anything that I would have expected Angus Wilson to write. That really attracted me. And then I discovered that it was this utterly hilarious book, first and foremost. It's very, very funny. But it seemed to touch on a lot of themes that were around at the time. Really.
So how did it speak to the 80s?
It spoke in terms of, I think, probably emerging issues around media ownership and the ability of the great media proprietors to affect the future of the nation in terms of the attitude to institutions. It spoke to the relationship between British institutions and government, the way in which institutions have to reflect or find their own way of living with the particular political philosophers of the time. And of course that was a rather entertaining little theme, given that we were working at the BBC at the time, and that's a kind of perennial chestnut of the BBC's existence, its relationship with government and its relationship with the newspapers. So I suppose those were some of the themes that sort of spoke.
And Margot, what were the practicalities of getting this story on the screen, securing the zoo's cooperation? You were filming scenes within the zoo that involved, well, there's a scene in which the animals are culled, aren't they? I mean, what was the zoo's attitude to this production moving in?
We found them incredibly helpful, but what I really enjoyed about working at the zoo was we had to come in very, very early in the morning to avoid the general public, who were allowed in later on. So you'd come through, and it was magical because the mists would lift and you would hear the gibbons, which is the beginning of the story. You could hear them all whooping away and sweeping around, and all the animals slowly waking up. So I have very, very magical memories of working on that show. But logistically, it was a nightmare, absolute nightmare to schedule, because all the different things that had to happen in it, because not many programmes that you have to ask a location owner of a house, please could we come and film, have a film crew, not a film crew, a video crew of about 50, 60 people trampling through your house. And, oh, and by the way, there's going to be a nuclear explosion, so we're going to have to wreck your staircase, your ground floor and your basement so that we can continue filming there. Will that be all right?
Jonathan, one of the differences between the book and the novel is how is the level of explicitness with which the post-apocalyptic world is pictured. We do get a strong sense of that in the novel, but the TV series materialises certain things that are just alluded to in the book.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, if you look at the credits, for people who are interested in that sort of thing, normally this kind of thing says dramatised by Troy Kennedy Martin, and this says a version by Troy Kennedy Martin. So I think Troy was very kind of clear at the beginning that he would want to develop the novel. And I think that's the kind of right word, because actually, if you watch the series and read the book, there's very little in the television series that is not mentioned in the book. However, there are elements which are expanded in the book, particularly in the last episode. Troy found nuggets in the book, which he then expanded. I mean, Englander, as far as I recall, is not quite so explicitly a fascist in the book, although Blanchard White, who comes in as to be in charge of the zoo, as chairman of the zoo, whatever it is very explicitly, I think, a fascist in the book. And in the book, it says that Blanchard White had plans to put people in the cages. And Troy sort of found that and then expanded it, really, to a whole last episode. I mean, I think television watchers amongst the audience here who know Edge of Darkness can see in The Old Men at the Zoo the kind of beginning of the exploration of certain themes around the managing of nuclear power that come through in Edge of Darkness, and other references as well.
And Margot, there is a moment in the TV series where we are allowed to see something that is present in the book only as a suggestion, this idea that political prisoners are going to be fed to the lions, aren't they, in a kind of like a Roman arena type situation. We see the lions and we see a cage full of you know, punks and other sorts of 80s riffraff face to face with these creatures. I'm just trying to imagine what the risk assessment was like.
Luckily, we didn't have to do enormous risk assessments in those days. I don't think the show would have happened if health and safety was that strict. But, of course, you did have concerns. One of the big things was trying to get supporting artists that were willing to be caged up all day with lions prowling around them within each of the cages. One was for women, one was for men. You did have the zoo people, the circus people, actually, Jimmy Club's circus people who provided the lions, were caged up with them, and the if you look very carefully in the women's cage, you'll see a very butch-looking woman in clothes who was one of the male keepers, and they had brooms and guns and things.
I remember reading the script and coming across the secrets, which I'm sure Troy had never told anybody about, where the lions I let loose, supposedly amongst the political prisoners. I can remember reading it and thinking, oh my God, that'll be really good fun on the screen, won't it? That's really fantastic. A few lions wandering around amongst us, it's fabulous. And then sort of, you know, in a producerial way, as you could in those days, the BBC sort of just making myself absent, really, when these sort of things were planned. And I can recall, actually, absolutely vividly to this day, going to the zoo, sitting there and seeing these, and just being absolutely, my breath taken away at the power of these animals as they came in. I looked at them and I thought, oh, I thought, my God, what happened? I hadn't really thought until then. What happens if this goes wrong? This really would be on the front pages of the
newspaper.
Huge
publicity in a family,
yeah. Yeah. And my contribution was to leave and go and have a cup of coffee somewhere else because...
Well, in case you've got blood on your tie.
I thought that probably Margot was better left off to deal with it herself. And I was shocked that anybody... had been irresponsible enough to envisage this on screen. I went off to find the person who was. I found him round the corner.
Jonathan Powell, Margot Hayhoe, thanks very much indeed. Well, I'm now back with Ian Sinclair and Margaret Drabble. In Troy Kennedy Martin's television adaptation, Britain becomes a brutal, explicitly fascist state. What fate does the original novel envisage for us, Margaret? It's not stated quite so explicitly as that, is it?
We're becoming subdued to Europe. We've lost our independence. We're having to kowtow a lot to the European powers. We're acknowledging that we're the second-rate power that we'd been for some time, probably without knowing it. We're not one of the big boys anymore. And you have to watch your P's and Q's.
Suddenly it emerges, there's a real nastiness under what seems to be originally quite reasonable in that Europe is trying to drag us into the modern world, trying to get rid of some old attitudes, and then you realise what comes with it is quite an overcooked package of a demented fascist demagogue who actually takes control in the zoo and wants to use the animals in bloody games.
But you're not clear if he's going to get away with it, because you're still being presented, even at the end of the novel, with the voice of reason, the voice of moderation, the voice of this sort of hopeful bureaucrat who thinks that all these excesses will pass. So you don't really know how far it's going to go, whereas you remind us that in the TV adaptation it's already gone too far. Here we're sort of on the brink of the worst, but we haven't quite got there.
Does it seem to you to be a good moment to be reading or rereading this book? I mean, with the kind of UKIP tendency in British politics, that kind of anti-Europeanism, perhaps a new kind of isolationism in British politics too, the way that the vote on involvement in Syria
with
went.
With a book of this calibre, it's always a good time to be reading it. It doesn't really matter, you know, I mean, in the way that Hamlet gets tweaked and reimagined constantly. I think this book is a novel of real substance that you can put into whatever's happening in the current mode.
How was the novel greeted at the time, Margaret? What was its reception like?
I think it was mixed. If I remember rightly, one of the Mortimers, either John or Penelope Mortimer...
Both of them,
that's what annoyed him. Both of them gave him bad reviews, and he had this image of them sitting in bed laughing at him, and he didn't like being laughed at, except when he meant to be funny. And I think he was very upset by this, and especially as John Mortimer set himself up as a satirist himself, and I think he felt they just hadn't understood the deeper currents of the novel, which I don't think they had either. I mean, I agree with Ian that this is a book that can be read at any period, and you will, because Angus Wilson lived through such important decades of international trouble, that you can find parallels, you can find prophecies and warnings right through it. And I think that he felt it was being read too shallowly.
The public are about to be let in to the zoo. So let's end by thinking a bit about Wilson's reputation and what happened to him after The Old Men at the Zoo. What was the trajectory of his career after this, Margaret?
After this novel, he wrote, I think, his best novel, No Laughing Matter, which was extremely well received. We're told now it wasn't, but in fact it was very well received. And he seemed to be on a sort of plateau of acceptance. He then wrote a novel called As If by Magic, which has been described as his first attempt at a global novel, and did reflect his travellings round the world, and he did go to every continent and whenever he was invited. And that was not a success at all. And the young generation, Martin Amis was particularly cruel about it. The Mortimers didn't count so much because they were Angus's generation and they were old. But he didn't like being attacked by Martin Amis. And in fact, as if by magic, I have to say, I don't think is as much of a success as No Laughing Matter. So he was experimenting, he was writing strange books still, he was still venturing onwards and outwards. But I think that with As If By Magic, he was trying to write about young people in a way that young people didn't see themselves in. And his last novel is quite baroque, Rococo baroque, setting the world on fire, and is set in an alienating world of public school and architecture. That I liked it because I like the way his mind works and I like all his reflections, but I could see that that novel was not going to be a success. And then after that, people took pleasure in criticising him rather than praising him, and he lost his classic status.
You were at his 70th birthday party, which took place here in the zoo. What do you remember about that night?
I remember it as being completely hilarious. I mean, Angus was on top form, brightly dressed, colourful, sort of cockatoo-like, dandy he was. Everybody was here. It was a great event. There were speeches of which I can't remember very much, I must say, but I do remember a sense of a kind of riotous licence of enjoyment.
I think what the great cultural accolade you could get is, say, you're Lucian Freud, you get a key to go round the National Gallery at night when there's nobody there and look at these paintings and meditate them. Maybe with poets, the great privilege should be given a key to come into the zoo and interact with the bison or the anteater or something, because zoos are places where they poets go to contemplate some otherness, this beast that will give them a language, a mammal language that is going to enhance their own. So let's start a movement now. Keys for poets to London Zoo.
Where does his reputation stand now, do you think, Ian? Because this is a man who, I mean, he was involved in the foundation of the creative writing course at the University of East Anglia. Has had a kind of behind the scenes influence upon British literature. But where is it now?
Important thing that he was right at the forefront of that moment of creating this idea of the creative writing course at UEA, and obviously had a relation with people like Ian McEwan, so that he was a sort of godfather to a lot of the new writing that was coming through, even though he may not have understood those people in that way. I mean, that course, Malcolm Bradbury was then involved, and Angela Carter, really changed what it meant, the idea of being a professional writer, having a career as a writer, passing through that. And he was pivotal that he came from the world, the old world of the British Library and the British establishment and the Arts Councils, into that new world, and therefore had a better take on it than pretty well anybody else.
There's a very interesting portrait of Angus Wilson as himself under his own name in Ian McEwan's Sweet Tooth. And there is Angus Wilson standing up against bureaucracy of the wrong sort and against politics of the wrong sort and being brave and heroic. And I was very relieved because I thought with Ian McEwan, who was also a bit of a satirist, it could have gone anyway. But I think it was very good to see Angus Wilson coming out as a hero in a minor role.
So as the zoo's carousel cranks up in the background, Ian, how should we remember him and this book?
Well, we should just Enjoy the presence of him, or enjoy him as a figure in the whole phantasmagoria of English literature, and someone who is well worth checking out. Go and search for the books. I mean, they can be found there in strange second-hand bookshops. I was looking at a whole shelf full in a little bookshop in St. Leonard's for 2 years, and I'm now cursing myself that I didn't get as far as picking up my copy of The Old Men at the Zoo. I was buying them one at a time, and it was like a secret initiates activity. And I think in some senses, you need to do a bit of detective work to go back to find him. And if you do find him, you'll find that he's one of the most remarkable figures of the period.
Ian Sinclair, Margaret Drabble, thank you very much.
Matthew Sweet, ending tonight's edition of Night Waves. The producer was Luke Mulhall, and you can hear the third of Matthew's zoo visits at the same time next Thursday evening. Tomorrow night, join Anne McElvoy. Her guests include Slavoj Žižek and Sir Richard Eyre. That's Night Waves tomorrow at the regular time, 10 o'clock.